Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's just about 10 seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's time for Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. I'll be talking on the show with Bob Banghart. The Alaska State Museum is having the official SLAM groundbreaking on Wednesday, and we'll be talking about that. Jocelyn Clark will drop by to give us a preview of her World Affairs Council talk on the two Koreas. Renewable energy program today. We'll talk with Chris Rose, the executive director of REAP, the Renewable Energy Alaska program. And Tom Milliron will drop by to tell us about the school district's ABID program. Those things, along with Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, the usual things for Juneau Afternoon. Weather looks like, well, see the rain out there? Guess what? It keeps up. As a matter of fact, it keeps up tonight. It keeps up tomorrow. It keeps up on Thursday. It keeps up on Friday. It's going to be all the way through for, Thursday night. And then Friday, it starts to snow. So that's what we have in store for the weather. National Native News is next, and we'll be back with Bob Banghart and the story of the SLAM groundbreaking in 5 minutes.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. 8th Circuit Court of Appeals Monday ruled the Fond du Lac Band is not obligated to share its gaming revenues from the Fond du Lac Casino with the City of Duluth, Minnesota. The decision is consistent with U.S. District Judge Susan Nelson's earlier decision and a ruling by the National Indian Gaming Commission. The city had received an estimated $75 million over 25 years. Fond du Lac Chairwoman Karen Diver had this to say about the ongoing litigation on tribal radio station WGZS.
So this is good news for the band. It still leaves the case, of course, lingering, and that will have to go back to Judge Nelson's court on the issue of the past payments. The City of Duluth has options, of course, to appeal to higher court. The Eighth Circuit has what they call en banc, which is asking the entire panel of all the judges from the Eighth Circuit to review it, or the U.S. Supreme Court.
In a press conference, Duluth Mayor Don Ness said the loss of revenue is devastating to taxpayers and the city. Native leaders in Wisconsin have been sharing their concerns about a planned iron ore mine. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio has more.
A mining company is trying again to open a massive taconite mine near the Bad River Chippewa Reservation in northern Wisconsin. Wisconsin legislators will soon debate a bill expected to try to relax state mining regulations. And if passed, that could help the proposed mine. Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins Jr. has been one of the leaders of an effort to block the mining operation, saying the mine could damage nearby groundwater, rivers, and wildlife. Wiggins took his message hundreds of miles south to Milwaukee, telling news reporters in the city that urban people should also oppose the mine.
This is about water, and fresh water is something that is growing more and more scarce. And if we don't stand up and protect what we have here in Wisconsin, where is that supposed to take place?
But Wiggins acknowledges that the Milwaukee area is also home to mining equipment manufacturers, like Phoenix Products. That firm makes high-intensity floodlights for mining shovels. The company's CEO, Scott Frederick, says he thinks Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources can approve the mine and protect the water near the Bad River Reservation.
And I love the area. I think between our DNR and what they've learned in our sister states, Minnesota and Michigan, I hope we can avoid the problems they've had. They really cleaned it up.
The tribal leaders say some of the mines in those other states do pollute or aren't the same type of operation as the large open-pit mine planned for the headwaters of the Bad River. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
A South Dakota college is sponsoring a lecture on a major Native village being studied in western Iowa. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Researchers have studied Kimball Village since the late 1930s. The initial dig in 1939 yielded more than 9,000 artifacts, including tools made from bone, houses, storage pits, and complete pottery vessels. The site in Iowa is the only one of the Big Sioux phase of construction, which covers a time period before the year 1250, that has been fully explored by archaeologists. This weekend, Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, is hosting a lecture on Kimball Village as part of its third Sunday series. Lynn Alex with the Iowa State Historical Society will host a lecture on recent discoveries at Kimball Village, covering a 150-year time period. The lecture is being held on the Augustana campus. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
During this month in 2003, a repatriation ceremony was held for the remains of Taino people removed from their graves in 1915. The Smithsonian Institution returned the remains of seven Taino people to their descendants in Cuba. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. This is a court-ordered legal notice for Native Americans. The Cobell Indian Trust Settlement is approved. If you believe you might be included in the settlement, you need to file a claim by March 1, 2013 to get a payment. Information is available at the website indiantrust.com or by calling 1-800-961-6109. That's indiantrust.com or 1-800-961-6109. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes and 14 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Weather forecast, it looks like tomorrow we're going to see a chance of rain in the morning and then rain in the afternoon, and the snow level should drop down to around 900 feet in the afternoon. In the midst of that lovely weather, we're going to have a groundbreaking ceremony, but as I understand it, it's going to be indoors. So I'm curious as to where the shovel will penetrate the soil, but anyway. Steve Simpson from THA Architecture, who's been working on the project, is here with Bob Banghart from the Alaska State Museum, and the groundbreaking is for the SLAM, which is an interesting acronym for
State Library, Archives, and Museum.
Yeah.
Project. Yeah.
I think most of our listeners will recognize Bob Banghart's deep bass voice talking about that. So what's the status of the project at this point? You've had a groundbreaking called the preliminary groundbreaking.
We had a preliminary groundbreaking in October a little over a year ago. And it was mostly to indicate that we had reached a fairly significant point in the design of the facility. This one is actually celebrating the digging in the ground. We've removed one of the buildings in the back. The contractor's prepping the area, and we're actually in excavation process right now. So this is truly the startup of the project. And we are at, with the governor's appropriation, which is still to be ratified in his budget, to ratify by the legislature, we're at $100 million with his contribution there. So we still need about 30 to final out on it, but the way the project's designed, the way we have to move into the new facility, we'll be building the vault and then removing the older building after we've moved in and then constructing the rest of it. And it's sequenced fairly well. We're optimistic the funding will come forward this year, and it does locks it in, and we'll be open to the general population in 2016, is our hopes.
Now, the effect of this is that the museum and the archives become one building with all of the offices housed under one roof.
Well, the State Library, Information Services, the Archive, Micrographics, the State Historical Library, and the museum, which constitutes the division of libraries, archives, and museums, which we're currently spread out in three spaces.
Yeah.
All is consolidated so we can take advantage of the opportunity to share utility structures for our collection preservation issues. It gives the division some holistic approaches to how we use collections, integrate staff. It's pretty interesting that, you know, we're essentially doubling the footprint of that division with the same size of staff, but we're going to see some significant cost reductions in our operating costs because of building efficiencies, new technologies. We're using saltwater cooling systems to take the heat from the building and return it into the building's usefulness as we'll use it as a condenser, basically. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to divine methods by which the building can be operated efficiently, economically, and it's got a 100-year life cycle. So there's a lot of redundancies built into the structures where if we go to a zone heating plan for the Willoughby District, we could join that, or we can be 100% oil fired or 100% electrical fired. It's a really nice, flexible, economic, and smart design.
So when they handed you this spec sheet and said, here's what we want the building to do, were you startled at all?
Actually, quite thrilled. We worked very closely with both the client group, Bob and Linda and Kim Mahoney, but also UCI Higher. And so this was coming from this city. This is a dream come true for me. I remember when the original building first opened back in 68 and being first exposed to all the artifacts that were in the museum. Gave me a greater sense of where I come from. It gave me a sense of pride. And to come back several years later mm-hmm. and be part of this has been an absolute joy.
Now, you're working with an Anchorage architectural firm as well, but THA is located in Portland.
In Portland. That's correct.
Right.
Yes.
And who's the Anchorage firm?
UCI Higher Architects okay. in Anchorage.
Okay, yeah. And they. What are the roles of the two firms relative to one another?
Well, we worked
without getting too technical.
We were very close knit. So when during the design process and in all the phases, we would spend time in their offices in Anchorage. They would come down and join us along with Bob and other people from the client group, and to come up with a design that works for the entire state, but also works in the city and is integrated into the city as well. So they will be doing most of the what we call a construction administration from here on out. We will still have a part in that. So that's where we are. And it's
visually, this is a large building, and yes. it's going to have a visual impact on the region right around. As a matter of fact, it's right out the back door of the radio station, but it will have an impact in that area. How did you how does an architect work that out? How do you flow it into the rest of the construction around?
Right, that's a great question because the overall size of the building is roughly 125,000 square feet. At two different levels, very high levels.
Let's get a perspective on that. What does that compare to? I mean,
I'd say it's at least a city block.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. So it covers most of a city block, and it's two stories, huh?
Right. And from there, you take the various parts of the program, and you start to break them down and give them specific identities. Like the library has an identity, the museum has an identity, the archives, which is the vault in the back, has an identity as well. So you take a look at the overall mass and start to carve it and make it, sculpt it, if you will. So it's a very, it's a building that's very strong in form, which we think is apropos for the state of Alaska.
And then you're going to be surrounded by the existing buildings that are here. The museum changes itself, right?
The museum, the existing facility will be taken down.
It disappears.
Yes.
Okay, so, but you're going to be surrounded by Centennial Hall down the street here and like that. But visually, what do you do to tie those elements together? Is that a consideration?
Well, in the overall master plan for this area, there's a strong plaza connection that ties all the way back to the state office building. Thank you. By the Centennial Hall, and then the terminus will be the museum, and so that's a very loose plan at this time. But so that plaza and promenade will link all those institutions together, making the neighborhood stronger, and essentially it'll become the arts district.
Okay, how does this tie into the borough's planning process?
Well, we worked when the facility was talking about putting itself together. The city was already in stream on some Willoughby District improvement and some plans. So we brought forward the massing that we had defined as our footprint for the building and our functions, and melded that with what the city had in its long-term phasing for improvements to pedestrian access, vehicular access, land use, density increases both for residential and light commercial. And so we're trying to be part of that overall master plan, knowing that in many instances we're driving that first stake in the ground with this facility. So it's always played in our dialogue. We've had a really good working relationship with the city on this project from the very beginning, highly supportive of it, and willing to look at our solutions and say, well, yeah, we hadn't thought about that, but I think we can work with that. And that's been really excellent. It's been a very high degree of fluidity throughout both state and government and city government in trying to get this accomplished. We're not a standard office building. We have a different mission. Mm-hmm. We have different requirements. They're above and beyond the circumstances that you would find for a standard office building. So we can't view ourselves in that core. And it was what was good in working with both firms in Anchorage and THA in Portland. We could get that mission driven through to them so their solutions reflected that. And then, in turn, we came back with solutions the city could understand because it was coming from professionals in the field. And they were able to articulate it a little bit maybe better than us inside the institution that may not have had that experience to get that word out.
So, Bob and Steve, what happens tomorrow at noon?
At noon, we're going to have a groundbreaking inside because it looks like it's going to continue on with this lovely weather today. Essentially, we're going to have Mayor Stanford has agreed to be the master of ceremonies. We're going to have short presentations from Commissioner Kemp from Department of Transportation, Public Facilities, and Commissioner Hanley from the Department of Education, and let people have a shot at a little photo op there. We've got a single shovel, and we've got a small tray of dirt that we're going to let people putz around in. It's just a little bit nasty outside to do that. But it's more of a situation. We're really making a declaration. We are beginning the project. This is going to be the first of a lot of milestones for this institution development over the next 3 years. So we just wanted to get everybody aware of that. It starts at noon. I don't imagine it will run past 12:30. We're going to have some hot cider and some cookies. The Friends of the State Museum are providing that and hosting the reception there. And everybody's welcome. And get your picture taken with a golden shovel.
Yeah. Steve, you'll be on hand as well?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Looking forward to it.
Well, it must feel to both of you like a sort of a place where you can go, ah, that's done, and move on to the next part.
Well, yes. Sort of. There's still a ways to go with this one. But, yeah, I'll have that kind of a, that's done probably about midsummer 2016 when I actually can put my head up.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you so much for alerting people to this. Noon tomorrow at the State Museum. Where in the museum?
Right when you walk in. Okay. We're going to actually have the speakers will be in the Eagle Tree area. We hope the audience will be ramping up around the ramp.
Oh, okay.
and it'll have two overflows into the SOS gallery and the main gallery there. And you can also get a preview of one of the new shows going up. It's really kind of nice. It'll be finished, and people can wander through that as well.
Okay. Well, right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow at noon at the State Museum.
This is Bird Note. This bird song seems familiar, intriguing. It's the song of the Eurasian blackbird. Paul McCartney and the rest of the Beatles most certainly grew up hearing Eurasian blackbirds in their home of Liverpool. Eurasian blackbirds are common in the gardens and throughout the countryside in Great Britain. It's no wonder the Beatles chose to weave it into one of their songs. But McCartney wasn't singing about the bird. He was singing about the racial strife in the American South in the 1960s. As he said later, this was really a song from me to a black woman experiencing these problems in the States. Let me encourage you to keep trying, to keep your faith. There is hope.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arrive.
It was a trying time, and Sir Paul said later that he saw the song as empowerment.
Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
It's 19 minutes, about 20 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and my guests are from the Juneau World's Affairs Council, and Jocelyn Clark will be giving a talk, I guess, tonight. Is that right?
No, next Monday.
Next Monday. Well, okay. and this is a talk about the two Koreas, and you have quite an interesting experience in both Koreas, I think.
No, I don't, and I won't be talking about the two Koreas. I'm going to be talking about popular culture, globalism, national branding, and these kind of cultural issues, especially cultural loss in South Korea specifically. Yeah. I won't be talking about North Korea, although I'd be happy to answer any question that you have, if I can, about North Korea.
Okay, you teach part-time at a Korean university.
I teach full-time. Full professor.
Okay.
And I have been teaching in the International Studies Department, and specifically, I've been teaching East Asian studies, and within that, I'm sort of on the arts and humanities side of things. Actually, I've just moved to a new department, which is a new kind of program that's been set up by the Korean government in all universities in Korea, which is called Cultural Contents Department. And it's been in that capacity that I've been asked to, for the last 2 years, to be teaching a class called the Korean Wave. And the Korean Wave is something that a term that was coined in the 1990s by some Chinese journalists who were noticing that Korean dramas especially were becoming really popular in China and later in Japan, and this is what they started to call the Korean Wave. What we call the Korea Wave today, as far as it's concerning the West, mostly has to do with the Korean pop music, so what they call K-pop, which is a take on the old term J-pop, which when I used to be here at K2, we had a collection of. I don't know if we have a K-pop collection or not, but really what I want to talk about is globalism and Korea's tremendous economic strides in the last just a few years, 10 years. I mean, I've been there off and on for 20 years now, so I've sort of been back and forth between Juneau and Korea, among other places, and tremendous changes, and Korea being the most sort of number one digitally connected country on earth, South Korea that is, the strides that they've taken towards globalism are bigger than the ones we've taken, at least here in Juneau, Alaska. And it's had really great consequences for traditional culture, Korean traditional culture, which is just fast disappearing. I mean, even in the 10 years that since I was last there, this time I've been there for 4 years. Last time I was there was the turn, 2001 or so, is when I came back to Juneau. So I was there from 1999 to 2001 before that, and then the first time I was there in 1992 to 1995. And the interest in traditional culture has virtually disappeared over that period of time. Language has completely changed since when I first started studying Korean to now. Everything's turning into English. In the schools, it's mandated by the government that I think 30% of every program has to be taught in English now, so there's lots of opportunities for people like me to go over there and become professors. But the consequences for the students in terms of interest in traditional language, meaning Korean, but meaning Korea's relationship to languages of neighboring countries that they've utilized, for instance, Chinese characters, has been disappearing. There's lots of things to talk about, but I'm very interested in sort of especially Korea's national branding campaigns, how they're trying to brand themselves in the world in terms of how they want to use soft power to become powerful on the global stage. I mean, they're a very self-conscious country and very self-conscious, my English is not good when I came back to America. very determined to consciously brand themselves, present themselves in that way to the world, and therefore be the Japan of the Japan that was the Japan of the 1980s in this century, I think, as far as East Asia is concerned.
In some ways, it seems to me that Korea's government, South Korea's government, has a really ready willingness to abandon old things. Several years back, I had the opportunity I was in Korea back in the 1970s, and I had taken a bunch of slides. And several years back, I took a class up at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and a fellow in the class had taken slides of some of the same places, and he had taken his pictures after the Olympics.
Yes.
And one of the things we noticed was that they had torn down whole neighborhoods in order to put up the Olympics, to prepare for the Olympics.
Well, that continues. And,
yeah, and it's kind of like almost heartless in the way that they approach these things.
Well, the Olympics in, what year was it, 1988,
yeah,
was Korea's arrival on the world stage in terms of, in the modern era. So, up until then, it was kind of, we thought of we meaning the West.
Yeah.
And I think it hasn't quite all the way disappeared, but in people's mind, Korea was, a war-torn, ravaged country of people sending their orphans to the West. And when the Olympics came, people were really amazed by Korea's Olympics, I think. And in the same way, I think we were amazed by Beijing's Olympics not too long ago. But even in the last 10 years, I mean, if we were talking about the 70s till now, and I'm talking about, 2000 to now, it's a completely changed landscape and a completely changed language, a completely different relationship to Korean tradition. And yes, as you say, there's been a tendency to just throw everything out and become global,
mm-hmm,
which means speaking English, which means becoming Christian, at least in, globalism is something that we've defined, or not that we define, but that's defined at the moment by the West, and it may not always be that way, but certainly if we look at those airplane maps you can see on the internet where they, where the flights are going. It's all mostly coming between, Western Europe and United States. So if the West is the globe, then Koreans are very much striving to become part of that. And being part of that means speaking English. Being part of that means being Christian. Being part of that means, being able to have a voice in popular culture movements, which is what the K-pop movement is about, which is what the Korean mm-hmm. wave is about. It didn't start off being that way, but as far as we listen to it and think about it today, it's really about being part of popular. I mean, in order to have some kind of soft power, you need to have something that's popular, right? That a lot of people are going to be interested in. So that means, popular culture is one of the main tools that they're using to gain soft power on the world stage. And, much of that capital has been spent in Asia. Most, the Korean wave is a big thing in Asia. It's much less of a big thing here. But now that we have, Psy showed up, and he's not really part of what we call K-pop, although now we have to include him, and he sort of single-handedly changed what we mean by K-pop. But anyway, in my talk, I want to look at, Psy, I want to look at soft power, I want to look at globalism, I want to look at the consequences for Korean traditional arts, because those of you who know me here in Juneau, you'll know me as the director of Crosstown Music Festival, mm-hmm. and also as a musician, playing as a player of Korean traditional music. So it's been something that I've been very interested in for the last few years. And I never thought I would be involved with these sort of Korean wave or popular culture lectures. But since my new position, I've been having a lot of requests from the Ministry of Culture, Sports, and Tourism. And in that capacity, I really started to think about Alaska in that context, and comparing Alaska situation, especially Southeast Alaska, Juneau specifically, to Korea, and what's the sort of situation with colonialism in Korea versus colonialism in Alaska? What's the situation with, if we're going to be a tourist town here in Juneau, you know, what do we need to think about in terms of branding ourselves or not branding ourselves? What kind of strategies can we use as a capital city or as a state to be something in the world besides just nature, pure and simple?
It sounds like it's going to be a really excellent conversation for everyone who comes to it. This is Monday night, and it's sponsored by the Juneau World Affairs Council.
Sponsored by the Juneau World Affairs Council, which is a nonprofit here in Juneau. It's our sponsors are Greens Creek, Sea Alaska, Kensington, Wassman and Associates, and GCI. So we have a good group of sponsors for this. It's free. K2 Studios, 5 o'clock on the 21st. I'd also mention that our big fundraiser, which is a lot of fun, the WorldQuest trivia contest, comes up the following Friday at 6 o'clock in the evening on the 25th.
Is that also at K2?
That's at Centennial Hall. We'll have more announcements about that, but I thought I'd mention it.
Oh, well, I hope you come back and we have a chance to talk at that.
We will next week.
I wish you a huge crowd for your conversation.
It'll be on 360 North as well for those of you who can't catch it.
So the presentations are here in the studio and we record them at the same time. Thank you so much. We have a piece of Korean music, which we'll listen to a little bit of to say goodbye to this guest. Thank you. Little Korean music there. Our guest is going to be talking about Korea on Monday here in KTOO Studios in the evening. She's the speaker, Jocelyn Clark, for the Juneau World Affairs Council. It's 27 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Writer's Almanac is next.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 15th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., born in Atlanta, 1929, the subject of many biographies since he was assassinated in Memphis in 1968. Taylor Branch wrote a trilogy about America during the King years, the trilogy Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. It's the birthday of the French playwright Molière, born Jean-Baptiste Poquelin, baptized in Paris on this date, 1622, author of The School for Wives, Tartuffe, The Misanthrope. Although he poked fun at the bourgeoisie, Molière was careful to leave the church and the monarchy alone, as a result of which he never got into trouble, and Louis XIV liked his work just fine. Molière collapsed on stage during a performance, 1673, finished the show, died of tuberculosis later that night. Molière, who said, "All the ills of mankind, all the tragic misfortunes that fill the history books, all the political blunders, all the failures of the great leaders have arisen merely from a lack of skill at dancing." It's the birthday of Frank Conroy, born New York City, 1936, author of 5 books, including his memoir Stop Time and the novel Body and so on. Supported himself when he was young, playing piano in jazz clubs, and he was pretty good at it, too. He was invited to the University of Iowa as a last-minute teaching replacement, ended up running the Iowa Writers' Workshop for almost 20 years. Frank Conroy once scolded a student for using irrelevant details in her short story. He said, "The author makes a tacit deal with the reader. You hand them a backpack. You ask them to place certain things in it, to remember, to keep in mind as they make their way up the hill. If you hand them a yellow Volkswagen and they have to haul this to the top of the mountain to the end of the story, and they find that this Volkswagen has nothing whatsoever to do with your story, you're going to have a very irritated reader on your hands." It's the birthday of Andreas William Heinesen, born in Tórshavn, the capital of the Faroe Islands, in 1900, the most famous writer to come from the Faroe Islands, though he wrote his work not in Faroese, but in the official language of the islands, which at the time was Danish. And it's the birthday of the woman who was the model for Violetta in La Traviata, Marie Duplessis, born in Normandy in 1824. Her father sold her off when she was 13 to an elderly bachelor, and she was a kept woman most of her life and a courtesan after that. She had many lovers who supported her well. She came down with tuberculosis as she began an affair with Alexander Dumas when they were both 20 years old. She broke up with him, she began an affair with Franz Liszt, and died at the age of 23, after which Alexander Dumas published his novel The Lady of the Camellias, which was about Duplessis, which was made into a play, which in turn inspired Verdi's opera La Traviata. Here's a poem for today by William Wordsworth. She dwelt among the untrodden ways. She dwelt among the untrodden ways, beside the springs of Dove, a maid whom there were none to praise, and very few to love. A violet by a mossy stone, half hidden from the eye, fair as a star when only one is shining in the sky. She lived unknown, and few could know when Lucy ceased to be, but she is in her grave, and oh, the difference to me. She Dwelt Among the Untrodden Ways by William Wordsworth. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses improve their online reputation and reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Mandolin Music announces that we're doing another program on sustainability in Juneau, and my guest today is a fellow who has had a hand in the funding process for a number of alternative energy programs that are going on around the state, including, as we talked about last week, the airport heating project that Doug Murray came in and told us about. So with me is Chris Rose, the founder and executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Projects, the organization that has worked hard to get us a funding source for alternative energy programs. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me about your organization.
Well, we are a nonprofit coalition of now 90 organizations. We have members from Ketchikan to Kotzebue, electric utilities, businesses and developers, Alaska Native organizations, environmental groups, consumer groups, and state and federal agencies, all sharing the goal of increasing the production of renewable energy here in Alaska and also promoting energy efficiency. So we're an education and advocacy group statewide.
And are there offices around the state, or are you out of your basement? Or
yeah, I wish we had offices all around the state yet. We have one office in Anchorage with five staff, me included, but we travel all around Alaska. I'll be going to Sitka later on this week. We've got people always going somewhere, and it's a big state. It's a challenge to meet everybody in the state, but All these different places around Alaska have different needs, too. I mean, we kind of call it at least a trifurcated approach. We've got Southeast, which has a lot of hydroelectrics. We've got the Rail Belt, where I live, in Anchorage, which is a grid-connected area. Then we've got, you know, 200 remote villages all around western and northern Alaska that have their own issues and are almost 100% reliant on diesel. So there are a lot of different issues. Energy efficiency is one common thread that runs through all places in Alaska, which is that we can certainly save more energy and keep dollars in our community.
Our discussions on these sustainability segments have largely talked about efficiency. Mm-hmm. We had quite a long conversation over several programs about reducing the waste stream, which mm-hmm. is boils down to really an efficiency question.
Right.
What ultimately will householders be able to contribute to increasing our efficiency in energy usage?
Well, one of the programs we advocate for strongly, and one of the programs we'll be talking about in Juneau this session, is HFC's, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's, weatherization and rebate program. So the weatherization program is for people who are just up to median income, and the rebate programs are for people who have a higher than median income. Either way, it is either a grant or a rebate to help you weatherize your home. So it's mostly thermal efficiency. And so far, of about the 17,000 people who have been part of that program, the average saving on thermal energy has been 33%. So an incredible amount of savings. I think the folks who've been through the program now are saving an average of $22 million a year, and that program just keeps expanding. We've probably only hit about 10% of all the residences in the state so far. So there's a lot of room yet for thermal efficiency. Electric efficiency, particularly in commercial and industrial and public buildings, is a big deal. The public building utility bill alone is estimated to be over $640 million a year. That's just the state public buildings. The municipal public buildings are paying that much. So there's a lot of room. And then, of course, on transportation, that's probably not as a low-hanging fruit as some of the other things I talked about, but we're wasting a lot of money on importing fuel that we use in our vehicles that we then waste. And so all of these things boil down to dollars leaving the state of Alaska.
And so your organization was formed when? How long have you been in existence?
We formed in 2004. When we started, it was about 16 organizations. And like I mentioned, we just hit 90 the other day. We're hoping we'll hit 100 here in 2013. So it's a pretty quickly expanding group of diverse stakeholders who all see the same vision, which is that not only is it a good thing for us to be energy efficient and to be more reliant on local sources of renewable energy, but it's a way for us to diversify our economy in the future. You know, right now we're 90% reliant to pay for government on oil revenues, and ultimately that will go away at some point. There are many different areas of clean energy, which is kind of a combination word for clean renewables and efficiency, that we could be first mover advantage in. For instance, 1.6 billion people on the planet with no electricity. Many of them live in villages like we've got in western Alaska. So we've been talking to folks literally around the world about what we're doing up here in these small villages trying to optimize small distributed energy systems. Tidal power, for instance, tidal and wave power. We've got 90% of the country's tidal power potential in Alaska, 50% of the country's wave power potential in Alaska. Who should be the leaders in those technologies? We think it should be Alaska, but it's going to take a vision and a lot of hard work to get there.
Is anything being done with tidal energy in Alaska at this point?
Absolutely. There are several developers who have been looking closely at the options that we've got up here. Of course, one of our disadvantages up here is we've got a really small load and great distances. And so even though we may have incredible resources, we don't have this incredible load to serve it. And so, one of the first commercial project FERC permits, for instance, was right there in New York City in the East River. Well, there's a big load there.
Yeah.
However, the first commercial project that went in is in Maine. And it was put in just this August by a company called ORPC, Ocean Renewable Power Company. We're very thankful to say that ORPC is a REAP member and has an office in Anchorage. So one of the leading companies in the country, if not the world, on developing this technology really wants to see some projects go in Alaska. And they're looking at a pilot project, probably first in Cook Inlet down by Nikiski, that would serve part of the Kenai Peninsula overload.
is there a vision eventually that tidal power would be of use further north? Because you have frozen oceans to deal with.
Perhaps not on the north coast of Alaska. I think the same hydrokinetic technology that we're seeing utilized in the ocean, though, could be used in rivers. So river hydrokinetics is something that we see potentially having big applications here in Alaska. And then again, as I said, maybe applications elsewhere in the world. There's a lot of people who live on remote rivers in Africa and South America and Asia who don't have electricity. I would compare tidal power and even wave power to where wind was 40 years ago. 40 years ago, wind was 90 cents a kilowatt hour, and they're letting contracts in the Midwest for big wind farms at 4 cents a kilowatt hour today. So it's very, very competitive today. But over 40 years, that technology advanced a lot for a number of reasons. First, they got the design down. We know we can make electricity with tidal power. The question is, how can we hone that design and optimize it so we're not taking it out of the water all the time to maintain it and to fix it? Once we get that design, then we can go to economies of scale production, and that's when the price starts going down. So a lot of forces driving toward development of technology like tidal, and we think within 5 to 10 years it'll be commercial and way more widespread than it is today.
Chris, it seems to me that someone interested in this could find a lot about the cutting edge if they were watching what REAP is doing. Are you on the web? Is there a place where citizenry can find out what you're up to?
Absolutely. Our website is realaska.org. So it stands for Renewable Energy Alaska. .org, and we update our website multiple times a day. As you said, there are things going on all around the world. We try to capture the most important things that are happening in the state and elsewhere and get that up so people can see what's going on.
I noticed when I was looking for information on your organization that if you Google REAP, you wind up with lots of things that involve the word reaping.
Right.
But you want to Google Renewable Energy Alaska, and you pop right up as probably about the second hit on a Google
search. Sure, or even REAP Alaska, and it'll come up pretty quick.
Okay, good. All right, well, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on what REAP is about.
Well, thank you.
And I wish you good luck in the funding fight.
Appreciate it. Take care.
On Tuesdays at 3:30, we've been doing a kind of a look at sustainability issues for Juneau, and we'll continue doing those over the next several weeks. Tune in every Tuesday at 3:30.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
Denali may be the tallest peak in the state, but the mountains of southeast Alaska jut straight up out of the water for thousands of feet. Those are the slopes where 19-year-old Quinn Asquith Hines of Haines has spent a lot of his life. He says he hiked a total of 110,000 vertical feet this past winter and then enjoyed the speed and the rush of snowboarding back down again. Snowboarding in the backcountry is something Quinn has done with his dad since he was a little kid.
I think it's good to always have something to look forward to and all that. Always have something I can enjoy so I don't get down. That's one thing I enjoy about snowboarding too. It's just me going down the hill.
Quinn has Asperger's syndrome, a developmental disorder on the autism spectrum. But despite the challenges that presents, it doesn't affect his commitment to the out of doors or his exceptional endurance. Jeremy Taylor is a family friend.
It's hard to find people that want to hike all day for one run and then have the ability to ski once they're up there and not be tired or still, you get a lot of big day ahead of you usually, even after you've hiked all day. So most people I go with are between 30 and 60 that can hike all day. Usually people younger don't want to hike all day. They want to build a big jump or do something steep or something crazy maybe, but not the big expedition style.
Quinn says he likes to be out in the wild.
It's like you're just in the moment, basically. I like just being in the moment instead of thinking about other things. Sometimes it feels good.
Quinn also runs, kite surfs, cycles, and hikes. He's a freshman this year at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Alaska State Division of Behavioral Health.
It's 11 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is Molly Box. She's with Floyd Dryden School here in Juneau. And she's going to talk to us a little bit about the program that we've heard about on Juneau Afternoon before. But we're in the part of the school year where people need to sign up for next year's version of this. It's called AVID. What does that stand for, Molly?
AVID stands for Advancement Via Individual Determination.
Okay. And since all advancement requires individual determination, what's this program about?
Great question. The program itself is helpful for a whole school-wide, for all teachers, even district-wide. We're trying to incorporate kind of best practices for reading, writing, inquiry, collaboration, organization. It's pulled a lot of great teaching methods out there all into one package, and teachers in every classroom can use AVID strategies. So that's one component of the program. The other one is an elective class, and the elective class is where students who voluntarily want to be in the elective class can apply to be in the program. There's some requirements, and then the program itself is the elective class targets kids in the middle, kids that maybe for whatever reason haven't thought about college as their future but are now considering college as one of their goals for their future, and they want some support in that endeavor.
If I understand what I've heard about AVID in the past, is it's not so much a course in English or history or anything like that. It's a deliberate attempt to try to teach study habits and the ability to take notes properly and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
That's the focus,
yes.
Right?
One big piece, it's even been called the binder class. There's a big component of organization to start with. Right now, all of our sixth graders are in an overview course of AVID, so they get some of the big pieces of AVID. Like organizing their binder, keeping a planner, and taking Cornell notes. And the Cornell notes, the big piece of the elective class as well. All of the students that take the elective course are required to take Cornell notes in all of their other academic classes.
Okay, come on now. What's a Cornell note?
Okay, Cornell note. So Cornell note is just a fancy, it was developed at Cornell University, and it's just a really...
Is this the thing where you fold the paper?
You can be, yes.
Yeah,
you can fold it to the study. It's a really effective method for taking good notes and studying your notes and pulling the most important information. It also gives students a way to interact with their notes and revisit them, because repetition, as we know, helps things solidify better in the brain. So it's research-based, and the Cornell notes is a big chunk of the AVID program and something that really supports our kids in their other academic classes.
Now, if I remember right, you fold the paper in half.
And it's kind of a third to two-thirds.
And then there's places where you write certain things, and you don't just take notes like you would write down what was said.
Right. Well, you may be just taking notes like normal. Kids can turn any kind of notes into Cornell notes. If a teacher is giving a lecture, or they're watching a movie, or their teacher says, hey, you need to know this chapter, they can take that information, write their regular just notes as they would normally write notes, and then the third of the paper is to pull the most important main ideas out with questions, so that they could cover up the information they got from the class, and then they can study by revisiting those questions that they created to pull the main points out of the lecture or whatever they were taking notes on. And then another big chunk of the learning is later on they revisit those notes, they highlight, they add, they delete, and then they summarize all of the information into one short summary. So it helps them revisit the information and kind of interact with their learning.
So this kind of these kinds of strategies that you give the students, it sounds like most of this is aimed at making them better students. Are there also parts of AVID that have to do with preparing students for leaving school and going out into the world?
Yeah, it's a huge piece. We do a whole component of career exploration in the high schools. I know that they're talking about what classes you need to be taking, where's your path, even setting them up for how to apply for colleges, what kinds of things interest them, and how to get scholarships. There's all kinds of pieces of that. The AVID program tries to incorporate lots of guest speakers and field trips and things to get them thinking outside of school as well.
How does this fit into the student's schedule? In other words, if a student is undergoing, now this is an elective, right?
Right.
So if a student takes the elective of doing AVID, what does that mean in terms of what happens to them between the time the bell rings and the time the buses line up to take everybody home?
Because it's an elective in the middle school, what kids will have is their regular academic classes, and then they have to, in 7th and 8th grade, they get a little bit of choices. In 6th grade, we try to get kids the whole gamut of exploratory quick classes is what we call them. But in 7th and 8th, they will have, each semester, they have two exploratory classes, which is an elective, and one of those classes for the full year is their AVID class. So one sacrifice they have to make sometimes is choosing between, do I want this AVID support? It's supposed to push them and reach their, ultimate potential in school, but they may have to give up something like PE or a music class, which can be a tough choice for kids.
Mm-hmm. It certainly could be. So is there any other avenue for getting the AVID training if you decide that you are going to take band?
Well, the hope is that the piece of the program that is we're definitely a work in progress. This is the third year in the district that we've had the AVID program, but the hope is that all kids will receive training from these AVID strategies and that it can go school-wide and that all kids will benefit from AVID, but that the elective course is really targeting kids that need that support in a different way. And the kid that looks at the elective course should fit a certain type of profile, but they come for different reasons. Sometimes they're the first generation in their family to go to college. Sometimes they're from a ethnicity that's been underserved in the past. So we look at each student individually, kids that apply, and then we decide which kids fit the program the best.
Molly, you work in a middle school.
Yeah.
Is this program also available at the high school level?
It is, yeah. We started 3 years ago with just 8th grade and 9th grade, and then each year we have expanded down and up a year. So last year it was 7th through 10th, and now this year it's 6th through 11th, with also a pilot program at Riverbend for 5th graders. Mm. So it keeps expanding each year. Next year will be our first year of seniors to graduate with the AVID program.
A 5th grader is kind of, it seems awfully early to be learning these study skills. Do you find that they carry it over into their later experience? You've only had this year.
Right. I'm a first-year AVID teacher, so I'm learning as well. But I think what I've noticed just from the 6th to the 8th graders is there's definitely a maturity, lots of growing that happens between 5th and 8th grade. But they're picking this up along the way, and I think some are ready for it, especially the organizational pieces, keeping your binder organized and knowing how to backwards plan for if I have a due date that's way out here 3 months, how do I set myself up so that I'm ready to meet that due date? Fifth graders for sure can learn those skills. It's definitely building blocks. And
would a student take AVID like in the 6th or 7th grade and then repeat it?
Yeah.
And is there growth built into the program?
Yeah, absolutely. The kids that apply are supposed to make a 2-year commitment, and for the most part that works out. There's sometimes kids choose to leave the program for other reasons, but one of the big pieces of the elective class that I didn't mention is the tutorials. And these students are being pushed into advanced classes and to where they're being challenged. So they're bringing questions from those classes twice a week to a tutorial process where they sit in groups of 6 or 7 with an adult tutor and 6 or 7 other students, and they use a really pretty structured process to ask questions of the person who's presenting their question from another class. So they're getting support through a tutorial process. That's really, and that grows as the students grow and mature. I know at the high school level, one of my colleagues says that the juniors are pretty much running their own tutorials now, and they really get it.
Okay. Molly, if a student wants to undertake the AVID program, they talk to their counselor, is that?
Counselors are great. Principals are the AVID elective teacher.
Okay, good. Thank you so much for telling us about this program.
Me. Okay.
You're in tune with KTOO. It's about 1 minute before, just a minute and a half before 4 o'clock. Pat Moore, been your host today. Enjoyed bringing you Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow, or actually, Wednesday, Andy Klein will be in. He's talking to Dr. Quigley Peterson. Laura Haywood and Tom Loker will be here to highlight Sunday's Juno Cabaret. And Julie Spiegel from NOAA will be here about a NOAA Observer, a program outreach meeting that's coming up tomorrow night, and the weekly update on Eagle Crest. KTOO is broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO's all broadcasts on a set of translators throughout the area in the Valley and Auk Bay. We're on K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on 88.1 MHz on K201 AM. In Hoonah, we're at 91.9 MHz on K220BT. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210AS at 89.9 MHz, and in Juneau, you can always receive KTOO Juneau on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871, KRNN is on 872, KXLL is on 873, and we are streaming continuously online at www.ktoo.org. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered.